Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video from the Christianity Engaged channel called What Keeps Evolution Up at Night? And I'm just going to warn you here, it is a massive gish gallop of statements that are mostly unrelated to evolution, so we're likely to be going all over the place for this one. Just to clue you in on the potential quality of the arguments, this video is by the same people who put together the list of top 10 reasons to believe in Jesus, and included on that list such things as the fact that people use Jesus' name as a swear word, the fact that we number our years based on an estimate of when Jesus might have been born that cannot possibly be correct, and the fact that stories about Jesus say that Jesus did impossible things. So that's the quality of argumentation we should be ready for here. Let's go! Okay, I know nothing has been said yet, but as a fan of bad puns, I can't let this go without comment. The therapist's name here is Hal V. Faith. Clearly, they're going for a pun name that will sound like have faith, but in order to get there, you have to not say V like the letter V, like you would any time you say someone's name and include initials. You'd have to actually make the V sound, which makes me wonder. Is this guy a fan of Jurr Tolkien or Ts Eliot? Even a bad pun has to make sense. A better name would be first initial B, middle name Leave, and last name Christian. Dr. B. Leave Christian. It's clunky, awkward, and feels forced, but at least it makes sense.
So what seems to be the problem, evolution?
I can't sleep, Doc. I've tried. Nothing works.
Okay, so as much as I like to encourage people to listen to my videos as a podcast, available at vicerhino.com/podcast, you're missing out on a pretty amazing visual here if you're just listening. They've decided to personify evolution as a hybrid monkey, lizard, bird, octopus thing. It's actually kind of funny, which is what they are going for, but one of the things that makes it funny is that it betrays the fact that they think evolution would necessitate the existence of hybrid animals, like Kirk Cameron's Crocoduck. Anyone who thinks that that is how evolution works does not actually know how evolution works. So this portrayal betrays their utter ignorance on the subject. A more sophisticated creationist might defend this choice by pointing out that it's just a silly joke, but when you make silly jokes about such things, not everyone picks up on the fact that it's not even remotely accurate, and then you end up with people like Gene Kim. Don't make more Gene Kims. Also, I've decided his therapists look kind of like Chuck Norris, so he's discount Chuck Norris. Chuckles Norris, if you will.
So what's going on?
Well, you know how I started out as an idea to explain how organisms adapt over time, right?
More accurately, it was originally formulated as an explanation for how so many species came to exist on one planet, hence the origin of species. And it is still an explanation of the origin of species, albeit one that we have a much better understanding of today than we did in Darwin's time. You're close, though.
Well, there are so many questions about the creation of the universe and the evolution of man that I just can't answer.
Evolution has nothing to do with the origin of the universe. The book wasn't called On the Origin of Universes, it was called On the Origin of Species. And here's a fun fact about scientific research. When scientists run into a question for which they don't have an answer, the correct course of action is not to throw your hands in the air and toss everything you've discovered thus far into the garbage, it's to do more research in order to figure out the answer.
It's keeping me up at night.
Roll credits.
I thought I had all the right answers, but there's still so much I don't know.
Which is exciting. Not knowing things means that there are new things that we can learn. This is actually pretty fantastic. Who would want to be stuck living in a world where there's nothing new to discover? How boring would that be? Leave it to religion to make the ability to learn new things into something bad that needs to be avoided.
For example, the Big Bang Theory is still the leading explanation about how the universe began, and it starts with a singularity followed by a period of rapid inflation. But there is still no explanation for how the singularity got there.
Yeah, so again, this is irrelevant to evolution. I'm not going to harp on that over and over again, so just take it as implied from now on. Every time he brings up something that isn't actually the diversification of species, and that includes abiogenesis, you can just mentally picture me saying that it has nothing to do with evolution. So, the Big Bang Theory. It does not, strictly speaking, explain how the universe began. Rather, it models the behavior of the universe from its earliest known periods until the present time, and it can be used to extrapolate into the future. So, no, there is not a widely accepted explanation for the origin of the singularity, which, to be clear, isn't necessarily some physical object. A singularity is a point in which the laws of physics as we understand them cease to function. There are different kinds of singularities depending on which property reaches infinity and causes the breakdown. Time-like singularities happen when the curvature of space-time becomes infinite, which turns into a trapped surface where time ceases to function, and that's the kind that gives us black holes. A space-like singularity is the one that might have existed before the Big Bang, as that is the one where matter is forcibly compressed to a point of infinite density, which causes the rules that govern matter to break down. That said, general relativity actually breaks down before it quite gets to a singularity, and so the Big Bang does not necessarily predict the existence of a singularity, as singularities are a function of general relativity. With regards to the question of what came before the Big Bang, the honest answer is that we do not know, and so we get to live in a time when it's possible that this question will be answered. How boring would life be if we just gave up every time we ran into a question where the answer is unknown?
Or how the first energy existed.
It's possible that energy is eternal. Well, I mean, there may well have been a time when time did not exist, though that's certainly the wrong way to say it. So energy might be eternal in the sense that it existed before time existed, in as much as the concept of before time is a coherent concept. It gets a bit wonky, you know, on account of the whole laws of physics breaking down thing.
Or how the four fundamental forces were formed. You know, the strong and weak nuclear forces, electromagnetism and gravity.
No, we don't know how the four fundamental forces formed. I'm tempted to say that that question is just nonsensical, but that would presuppose knowledge of the four fundamental forces that we just don't have yet. And just for background, the four fundamental forces are gravity, the weak force, electromagnetism, and the strong force. We're all familiar with gravity. The weak force is what causes particle decay and fusion. Electromagnetism deals with charged particles and their interactions. And the strong force is basically what keeps the subatomic particles of atoms together. Obviously, these are gross oversimplifications, and it's actually possible that these four fundamental forces are not fundamental. There may be one single force behind them all. So, at this point, we don't know enough about the fundamental forces to even know for sure that they are, in fact, fundamental. And you're surprised that we still don't know their origin story? For all we know, it's not possible for them to be different. And that's without even getting into all the different cosmological models that allow for an infinite number of universes, in parallel, in series, or both, which would allow for these forces to operate differently in each universe, thereby allowing life to develop in the universes that are capable of sustaining life. So, yeah, we don't exactly know where they came from, or why they are what they are, but there are several options that we know are possible.
Science has no clue.
Science actually has several clues, we just haven't developed a way to put these various hypotheses to the test quite yet.
We know the universe had a beginning, but the best answer from some of the brightest scientific minds is that the universe created itself out of nothing.
Loaded language aside, that is one hypothesis among many, and I may be wrong here, but I don't think that it's the most popular one among cosmologists. And even if it were, every time I hear a cosmologist talk about what came before the Big Bang, they pretty much always caveat their statements by pointing out that there are many competing hypotheses, and we don't currently have the ability to figure out which one is actually the right one.
And now, recent discoveries show that 96% of the universe is made of matter and energy we can't see, feel, touch, or even understand.
I don't like that dark matter and dark energy always get lumped together. The word dark just means that at this moment we can't directly detect it, or don't understand exactly what it is. So to split them up, dark energy is the name given to the phenomenon that causes the expansion of the universe to accelerate. With our current models, the expansion of the universe should be slowing down as time goes on, but it's actually doing the opposite, and we haven't quite figured out why yet. So dark energy is essentially a placeholder for whatever is causing that. Again, there are multiple hypotheses, but none have clearly won out over the other ones, though there have been some clear losers. Dark matter is mass that, judging by the behavior of the observable matter in the universe, has to be there in order to account for gravitational effects. So we see a star moving in this particular manner, therefore there must be mass gravitationally tugging on it in that particular direction. And again, there are many competing hypotheses as to what dark matter might be. It could just be normal baryonic matter that is hard for us to see, baryonic matter being the type of matter that we are used to, matter made up of protons and neutrons. Non-baryonic matter is a broad category of essentially all the other stuff, matter that is not made up of protons and neutrons, so electrons, neutrinos, photons, etc. So dark matter could just be a collection of normal baryonic matter that we can't detect for one reason or another. Now, we actually do have some pretty good ideas of what dark matter is not. It is not antimatter, because the signature gamma rays that are emitted by matter-antimatter collisions are absent. It is not large dark clouds of baryonic matter, because that would absorb radiation that passes through them, and so would turn up on a spectroscope. And we know it's not large galaxy-sized black holes, because such black holes would show up through gravitational lensing. But as far as what it is, the leading hypothesis is that dark matter is made up of as yet undiscovered particles, such as axions, which are in a category of non-baryonic matter known as weakly interacting massive particles, abbreviated to WIMPs. But again, we haven't figured it out yet, therefore evolution is false, is an argument that just doesn't follow. And if I ignore that it's just a complete non sequitur, it ends up being an argument from ignorance. It's a fallacy wrapped up in another fallacy.
And to be honest, we actually know very little about the other 4%, which includes all the stars, planets, and galaxies in the universe that we can see.
Yeah, the universe is big. To expect that we should know the majority that there is to know about it by now is a pretty big display of hubris on your part. We've only been studying it for 10,000 years, if I'm generous, and you expect us to know the majority of what there is to know about the entire universe, including everything about its entire 13.8 billion year history? That is just ridiculous.
I could see why this might be troubling you.
I can't. What troubles me is that apologists will accuse the atheists of robbing the world of its wonder. But here the creationists are, sitting there, talking about how horrible it is that we don't know everything yet, that we still have stuff to learn, that there are mysteries to solve and problems to figure out and things to wonder about. Meanwhile, they want to distill all this shit down to God, as though that is supposed to somehow create wonder.
And that's not all. I've been thinking about the probability of the universe creating itself out of nothing, and I just can't wrap my head around it.
Probably because it's a calculation that's impossible to do with the limited data that we have thus far. But of course, being a creationist, you're probably about to plug a bunch of completely arbitrary numbers into a formula to come up with an improbability factor that is ridiculous enough to even account for two hitchhikers getting picked up before they die in the vacuum of space.
Energy, matter, and time, creating the four fundamental forces of nature, forming all the stars, the planets, and galaxies.
Okay, you do know that one of those follows directly from the other one, right? Like, if the fundamental forces are what they are, then stars, planets, and galaxies will form accordingly because of the fundamental forces. These aren't independent and separate events.
All from completely random and unguided processes?
No, like I said before, the fundamental forces guide the processes that determine how matter behaves. And, like I also said before, we don't even know if it is possible for the fundamental forces to be different than they are, so to just assume that they could have wound up being any random number is a completely baseless assumption.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, when you mischaracterize a bunch of stuff, it does tend to stop making sense.
But let's just go with it for a moment. Assume the improbability of the universe existing as I just mentioned. Do you know the odds of a planet within that universe possessing all the necessary requirements to support life?
No, and neither do you. But it is non-zero. And given how many small rocky planets exist within their star's habitable zone that we have observed, then conservatively speaking, there are at least 300 million of them just in the Milky Way galaxy, with the upper estimate hitting 40 billion. So, given how many of them there are just in our own galaxy, and given how many galaxies there are in the whole universe, I'm just gonna go ahead and say that the odds of one of them turning out like Earth are pretty good.
We're talking about over 200 parameters. It would need the right temperature, which requires a certain proximity to a star, the right atmosphere to regulate temperature and protect from the star's radiation, a large planet like Jupiter to attract incoming asteroids, an abundance of liquid water, plenty of nutrients, and the list goes on and on.
Yep, there is a lot that has to work in our favor in order for the Earth to be habitable. But again, given how many planets there are that have the potential to have those characteristics, it's not really surprising that at least one of them does. And that's even just considering life as we know it. There might be life out there in the universe somewhere that exists on planets that would be completely inhospitable to even the most extreme of the extreme files that can be found on Earth, and that life might be looking out at the universe, seeing all the Earth-like planets out there, and declaring that their god must have designed the universe just for them, because there's way too many Earth-like planets in the universe. They needed their specific type of planet around their specific type of star in order for life as they know it to work.
The probability of Earth prevailing by random chance is absolutely inconceivable.
Again, who said it had to be random chance? That's something I hear all the time from creationists, but I have never heard an astrophysicist or cosmologist talk about the formation of the Earth or universe as a completely random chance event.
Statistically speaking, it's practically impossible.
And if it's practically impossible, then that means that it is possible, but very highly improbable. Now, given the size of the universe and how long it's been around for, we can expect that many, many extremely improbable events have happened in it. In fact, they are happening all the time. Consider the fact that you are watching my video right now, or listening to my podcast. Do you know how improbable it is that all of my ancestors would have combined their genetic material and had just the right mutations to eventually produce specifically me? And all of your ancestors had to have all the right combinations and mutations in their genetic material to specifically produce you. And the same goes for all the people who made all the internet and computer stuff that I use to make my videos. And all of the scientists and researchers who came before them to make their work possible. And then you have to figure out how likely it is that you would find my videos or podcast. Add all of those improbable things together, and you get something that is practically impossible. So, possible but highly improbable. Literally any mundane event can be stated in terms that make it sound like a statistical impossibility. That doesn't mean that it actually is impossible.
And that's just where I get started. Even if everyone accepts the idea of the universe creating itself out of nothing and the statistical miracle of Earth's existence and its unique ability to support life, now they expect me to explain how molecules came together to form living organisms.
Nope, that's abiogenesis. And again, while there is a shit ton of research being done on abiogenesis that gives us a really good idea of how it probably happened, we don't know all the details of every single step for sure at this time. If you'd like more information on this, I highly recommend the two-part video response to James Tour that can be found on Professor Dave's YouTube channel. It goes through a lot of the cutting-edge research on abiogenesis and interviews a number of the researchers, all while throwing amusing jabs at James Tour, who is unfortunately one of the more painful intelligent design scientists, because he actually does do really good work in his field of expertise, but his expertise doesn't translate to origin of life research, even though he pretends that it does.
And eventually evolved into humans over time.
And we finally get to evolution. I mean, we're only halfway through the video. That's usually how long it takes creationists to get to their main topic, so par for the course, I guess.
And I'm discovering so many gaps in my knowledge.
And do you think those gaps would be a good place to put God? Because that's what you seem to be going for. You're literally just a couple of words away from having actually made the fallacious argument with the exact name of the fallacy.
Can you give me any examples?
Of course. Even with all our advanced technology we have today, scientists can't replicate the production of single-celled animals from the primordial soup.
So? There are plenty of natural processes that happen all the time that even with all of our modern technology, we just can't duplicate them in the lab. That has no bearing on whether or not they happen. Hell, pregnancy is something we can't do in the lab. Scientists are unable to bring a fetus to term using their science-y technology. You are using scientists' inability to recreate abiogenesis to say that abiogenesis can't have happened, and yet we all exist because we went through a natural process that scientists are unable to recreate. Using creationist logic, the human race doesn't exist because scientists can't completely duplicate human reproduction in a lab. And of course, science keeps advancing and learning how to do new things, so I guess that changes what's possible in the natural world? A little over a century ago, birds couldn't fly because humans hadn't figured out how to make things fly yet. And I'm so glad that human history was entirely free of infectious disease up until humans learned how to grow bacteria and viruses in labs. That sure worked out well during the Black Plague. If you use humanity's ability or inability to do something as evidence that this thing is impossible, then you are creating a patently absurd measuring stick.
We can't prove how single-celled animals evolved to become multi-celled animals with completely different cell structures.
Well, not only do we have some pretty good ideas about how that could have happened, but that's actually one that we have managed to do in the lab. So, using your ridiculous measuring stick of possibility, that one should be possible even in your worldview, because we've done it. Also, it's an easy enough process that seems to have happened fairly frequently on the early Earth, or at least we have evidence of several instances where multicellularity developed independently.
And we certainly can't explain how eyes, ears, brain tissue, and lung tissue developed from a single cell.
See, now this is why gish galloping sucks. You get to throw out all these things together in a big clump and then claim we have no answer. And when I answer, I either have to give a detailed account of everything that you just ran through, which to do thoroughly would take at least a few hours, or else I can offer summaries and partial explanations, which will then leave the door open for you to find areas that I inevitably missed or summarized less than perfectly, in order that you might say, "Aha! You might be able to explain away this and that, but you failed to explain the other." So, for brevity's sake, let's just focus on the brain. I'm pretty sure that's the one of those systems that I've covered the least on my channel thus far. The brain is an organ whose primary purpose is essentially to coordinate the actions of the individual cells and organs throughout the body. It accomplishes this through a variety of mechanisms, from hormones to electrical impulses to other chemical signaling. Now, researchers have found that most of the major components required for the transmission of electrical and chemical signals can be found in a type of single-celled organism known as a choanoflagellate, which I'm sure I've pronounced completely wrong. This is not entirely surprising, but it is significant, as this is the group of single-celled organisms that is thought to be the common ancestor of all animals, about 850 million years ago, so it's not exactly the same thing, but it's the same category. This suggests that all the major components that could be used to build simple brains were already there when animals first developed. Once multicellularity developed, the first step toward developing a brain was the streamlining of the chemical signaling process. Cells developed that could use electrical impulses to send chemical signals to each other over shorter distances, thereby speeding up reaction times, and these were the beginnings of a nerve net. From there, some neurons began to develop in groups that would allow for the processing of information rather than just a direct stimulus-response reaction, thereby allowing these animals to begin responding to their environments in more complex ways. About 500 million years ago, after the development of these simple neuronal groupings, there were two whole genome duplication events in the chordate lineage. This provided a plethora of extra genetic material already programmed to build basic brain material, which could then, through mutation and natural selection, develop larger, more specialized brains. About 200 million years ago, as the lineage that led to modern mammals diverged from the reptile-bird lineage, the competition for survival between the proto-mammals and the dinosaurs led the proto-mammals to develop larger brains relative to their body size, starting with the olfactory bulb, allowing these early mammals to sniff out food that might be missed by the dinosaurs. Yada yada, new pressures after dino extension led to various developments that eventually allowed for the evolution of the human brain. This is a very, very basic summary of how the brain likely developed, and it's a simplification of a simplification of the process, so I likely missed a lot. There really is a lot of research into the topic that you are free to look into anytime you like if you actually want answers to these questions. But in my experience, creationists don't like actual answers. They prefer the "I don't know" answers that can be used to stuff God into the equation.
Or how single-sex organisms evolved into males and females that sexually reproduce.
Again, the answers are there if you're willing to look for them. As with multicellularity, sexual differentiation has evolved multiple times in multiple lineages, leading to several modern species that do things quite differently from what we are used to. But the gist of it is this. It most likely started with simple organisms that were capable of reproducing asexually, but which developed methods for the simple swapping of genetic material. Over time, these swaps specialized into cells known as gametes. Initially, the gametes were all the same, but to make the transfer process easier, some differentiation developed, not quite sexes, but mating types, making it easier for some to give gametes and others to receive gametes. Once this differentiation occurred, it then made it easier for the gametes to differentiate in order to make the process more efficient. And then we yada yada through a few million years, and boom, penises. Actually, fun fact, Penises appear to have their evolutionary origin in a mutation in the location where the cloaca develops in a fetus. Researchers grafted cloacal tissue next to limb buds on chicken fetuses, and the result was a cock that grew a cock. A rooster. Whatever. And I might be exaggerating that a bit. They started to grow external genitalia, but I didn't see anything about them finishing the process. But hey, another fun fact, you might not know this, but snakes have two penises, and they develop right where the leg buds begin to grow in the snake fetus. And guess what else? You know how most mammals only have one penis? Well, they develop in the same area as the tail bud. So it looks like how many penises an animal has is the result of where the cloaca moves on the fetus. Put it where two legs come out, and you get two penises. Put it where one tail comes out, and you get one penis.
And here's the thing. Even if I could explain all that, I still have no way of explaining the lack of complete fossil evidence to support mankind evolving from apes at the other end of the spectrum.
The word complete in that sentence is doing a hell of a lot of heavy lifting. We have plenty of fossil evidence for this transition, and this video still has a bit left to go, so rather than go into detail on that here, I'll just leave a little card to a previous video of mine where I discuss human evolution by way of responding to Answers in Genesis.
It's just completely overwhelming what they expect of me.
Well, it sounds like you're really starting to have some doubts, evolution. So do you still have some faith in your theories?
No, because faith as defined in the Bible is the assurance of things hoped for and the convictions of things not seen. In other words, belief without evidence. There's tons of evidence for evolution. Finding a few unanswered questions doesn't negate any of that evidence, even if I were unable to find a lot of answers to the questions that you're asking without too much trouble.
Well, even the guy who got me started, Charles Darwin, had his doubts.
That is completely irrelevant. Darwin himself could have recanted and become an outspoken young Earth creationist after having published his book, and the study of evolution would have carried on happily without him. Science does not have authority figures like religion does. We don't have any person who is supposed to be infallible with whom we must agree on every point. In fact, science works in rather the opposite way. The scientific method is designed to essentially try and prove hypotheses wrong. You hypothesize and then figure out what would prove your hypothesis wrong, and then try to prove it wrong. If you fail, then other scientists come at it from different angles, finding new ways to prove it wrong. And only after it has failed to be proven wrong from several different angles does it become accepted as a scientific fact, provisionally, pending the potential future discovery that might still prove it wrong.
I don't know. I guess I have doubts of my own, but I don't really have another plausible alternative.
You don't need a plausible alternative in order to prove something wrong. The plausible alternative comes later. Some of the worst science gets done when researchers come up with a plausible alternative in advance of proving the accepted hypothesis wrong. This is how you end up with fringe groups like the Birds Are Not Dinosaurs organization, who have their plausible alternative already worked out, and so rather than accept the science that goes against their hypothesis, they try to twist things to fit into their alternative, and it doesn't really work. Plausible alternatives are what you look for after evidence comes to light that casts doubt on the current accepted hypothesis, not before. And so far, you don't have evidence. You just have unanswered questions. Or rather, questions whose answers you are ignoring.
Actually, we do have another alternative.
Is your alternative magic? I feel like it's going to be magic.
One that I believe has more proof and less gaps. The universe was intelligently designed by an eternal creator God who fine-tuned the cosmos to create a planet that would support life for you and me. He skillfully crafted all living organisms to inhabit this special planet.
Magic. Great. Yeah, it has fewer gaps, because you can use that as an answer to literally any question. And an answer that equally answers every conceivable question isn't really an answer at all. Call me when you figure out a mechanism that God uses to do, well, anything. Tell me exactly how he did a thing. Anything. You choose. And nothing vague, like, he formed man from the dust of the ground. Give me specifics. What process did he use to convert dust into flesh and blood? Breathing on it? How does that work? How did God breath convert dust into a living organism? Can it be replicated in a lab with all our fancy schmancy modern technology? You said that this answer is supposed to be filling in the gaps, so get filling. Give us some real answers.
And he crowned his creation by making human beings in his image.
What that even means is a whole other can of worms that I don't want to get into in this video.
He gave us many wonderful qualities that set us apart from everything else that he made.
Name one. I'll bet we'll be able to find it in another species somewhere. Often in a more basal form. Kinda like would be expected if such traits were evolved rather than having been specially created.
One of these is our intellect.
Yep, there you go. Fun fact, but the animals that are intellectually the most similar to us also tend to be the most closely related to us. Almost like that's an evolved trait.
He gave us minds that feel a pressing need to understand where we came from and discover our purpose.
Well, those kinds of subjective feelings are difficult, if not impossible, to measure in other animals that we can't communicate with. Certainly, there are many that express curiosity, and despite having killed the cat, curiosity seems to be a trait that is very widespread throughout the animal kingdom, which suggests that there is a survival advantage to being curious. So, tell you what, you figure out how to test for a sense of purpose in non-human animals, do that research, publish your results, and then we'll talk about that one. In my opinion, that sort of feeling likely is a byproduct of the trait of curiosity.
Some people believe that life just happened by accident, and they explain the complexities of our existence from the wonders in space to the information coded in our very DNA as simply a result of time, matter, and random chance. They believe there is no design, no designer, and ultimately no meaning or purpose for our existence.
Ultimately, there probably isn't meaning to our lives. Why should this have an impact on whether or not our lives have meaning in the moment is just beyond me. I have experiences. I have good reason to believe that the other people I interact with also have experiences. I prefer to have good experiences, and I also have empathy, so I enjoy helping other people have good experiences too. And so, a good purpose, in my opinion, is to live your life in a way as to maximize the good experiences for yourself and those you interact with. And hey, speaking of trying to make people's lives better, I don't think I've mentioned the final amount raised for the fundraiser for Project Share in memory of Mrs. Rhino yet. It was $41,840. Well done, everyone. She would be so proud of you. It's an excellent legacy. And after we're gone, what is there but the legacy that we leave behind for others?
Quite honestly, I believe that view requires more faith than I have.
This is a nice slippery little game with apologists where faith is obviously a bad thing. I don't have enough faith to hold your position, you have faith because it's bad. But then should I point out that faith is the belief without evidence, and evolution has evidence while God does not, then suddenly faith becomes a synonym for trust, and it's a good thing to have. The definition of faith that apologists use tends to shift depending on what is convenient in the moment. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day is not going to be a comment of the day. Instead, I would like to offer my sincere, heartfelt thanks to everyone who has pitched in over the last month. It has been the most difficult month of my life so far, and the support that I've received has made it that much easier to bear. Paul of Paulogia immediately started coordinating guest videos so that I could have some time off. All the creators who have helped with either the scripted videos or their live presence for their live streams have been great. And goddamn Shannon set up a wish list with an excessive amount of gift cards on it, which people were actually buying. So everyone who bought a gift card and sent a note, the family read them all and my daughter collected them all into a little gift box that is sitting on the tree. They are very much appreciated. Also, thank you to Furry Skeptic, who's been doing the guest avatars with the little Mrs. Rhino bow on them. That was very much appreciated. I like that detail. And I have another flurry of PayPal donors to thank. Between them and the gift card squad, it has definitely made Christmas about as good as I could hope for it to be this year. So, thanks to the PayPal heroes, Steve, Austin. Hi, Austin. Love your work. I don't know if he's okay being publicly associated with me, so I'm not going to give his last name, but holy shit was I surprised to see him on the notification. I fanboyed out a bit. Deborah, Michael, Lori, Richard, Christian, Jacob, Alan, Richard, Gabe, Stephen, Chris, Holbrook Junior Senior High School Robotics, David, Claude, Richard, Daniel, Stephen, Mary, Martin, Janos or Janos, depending on the language, Alicia, Ryan, James, Scott, Barry, Samantha, Charles, Brian, Nicholas, Zachary, Tyler, Christopher, Juan, and Henry. Special thanks as always to my patrons, iOS Tiltbill Gamer, Bryn Pound, Clench Eastwood, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, Mark Hetchum, and all the rest, who are the limbuds that determine the location of the penis that is my channel. If you'd like to have cloacal tissue grafted onto you, then you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist. Links to social media and all the ways to support the channel and to my other projects like my podcast with my daughter, which is on hiatus for the moment, but should be resuming in January, can be found at links.vicerino.com. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time!